there's clear changes in policy that can be reversed in a new government, but then there's a real human damage and impact that these policies have caused. I work with a lot of undocumented folks, and they've been living in a moment of terror. I think the damage, sadly, is generational. It's prolonged, and I think we have a lot of work to do.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Immigration policy and politics are a mess in the United States right now, and the Trump administration has obviously made things much worse. Rodrigo Camarena is a good person to talk to about this. He's the director at the Immigration Advocates Network and is steeped in the challenges and is working on the solutions. The Immigration Advocates Network works to expand access to immigration, legal resources, and information through collaboration and technology. They bring campaigns and tools of justice to immigrant communities, including products and platforms for immigrants and their advocates. They're doing good work, and you should hear about them. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Rodrigo at Immigration Advocates Network.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
My name is Rodrigo Camarena. I'm the director of the Immigration Advocates Network. And as far as a biography, I have been working in immigrant advocacy for the last 15 years. I started my work in direct services, running a small nonprofit immigrant advocacy organization here in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. Did that work for a number of years, realized that the work that I wanted to do was much bigger than what was happening at the small community level. And so I started working on broader statewide advocacy issues and worked in issue advocacy for some time, dealing with a range of issues from the environment to refugee rights and immigrant rights. And I'm now at the Immigration Advocates Network as our director after this broad experience in civic tech, digital organizing, and immigrant advocacy.
It sounds like you've found a place where you want to be.
I think so. You know, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm originally from Mexico. I was raised between both countries. And for me, coming to the Immigration Advocates Network, we call it IAN, was really a culmination of a number of experiences. I worked for some time for a strategy consultancy called Purpose that works on progressive advocacy issues. And the work and experience that I gained there, thinking about how to move an issue forward, how to engage people in caring about a cause and moving a target, I think really brought me to think more broadly around how we, as a movement, really empower immigrants and their advocates to do the best work. So IAN, the Immigration Advocates Network, is really a place that brings together immigrant legal advocacy, civic technology, and digital organizing all to one place.
That's a lot of stuff in one place. How big of an operation is it?
We are a small but mighty team. There's about 8 of us, but we're actually part of a larger legal tech nonprofit called Pro Bono Net that's been working in this space for the last 20 years. So IAN started out in 2007 as a project of Pro Bono Net and a recognition among national immigrant advocacy groups for there to be an organization that helps build capacity of advocates around the country in a way that's decentralized, free, and available online. So we were early to kind of networking advocates together and bringing them some critical infrastructure and tools to help them do their best work.
What other areas does ProBono.net work in?
So ProBono.net is in the civil legal justice space. We do work in housing. We do work in family law. We have tools that are used throughout the U.S. and in various court systems. You know, essentially, we operate as a platform builder for the civil legal aid field.
Are you sort of housed with them, or are you out in a separate place?
That's right. We're housed in them. Our team works remotely, so we're all over the country, especially now. But we really leverage the experience and expertise of ProBono.net to do what we do. So while we're, you know, a small team, we're building off of technology and relationships that ProBono.net has built for the last 20 years.
So tell me more about Immigration Advocates Network. You got a lot going on there. Kind of go through the different projects that you're working on and the tech and everything else.
In essence, we're really two things. We are a network, like our name says. We're a network of around 8,000 advocates nationwide. These are both legal advocates, nonprofit legal advocates, so lawyers and Department of Justice accredited representatives, but also just nonprofit staff that works and helps immigrants in their day-to-day. So we're a network of 8,000 members. We provide them with resources online. There's a digital library. There's a newsletter. We have our own podcast, actually, for the field. And so that's one aspect of what we do, and it's the most traditional aspect of what we do. And then the second big thing that we do is that we essentially act like a immigrant justice lab for the space. And that means that we build critical technology and infrastructure for the advocacy space, immigrant advocacy space. So as a very simple example, we created years ago what is now the only and largest nonprofit immigrant legal services directory, which is, you know, sounds really simple, right? But before Ian came along, this directory of, you know, where do I go for legal help that's free, reliable, and in my area was a paper-based resource that existed in the offices of, you know, a few partners. So if you go to immigrationlawhelp.org, you can find a number of providers nationwide by zip code, by detention center, or by city and state. And so this directory is now part of dozens of websites around the country. It's sort of become this free API that we provide to our partners to kind of maintain the field connected. And so that's a really early example of what we've built. But a more recent or newsworthy example is in 2012, we came together with United We Dream to build a tool called Pocket DACA. So you might remember Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an Obama-era policy. Suddenly, teenagers needed to figure out how to fill out a legal form. And if you didn't have access to a lawyer or a workshop, you were kind of on your own. So we built Pocket DACA to be a tool, an app that you would download and would walk you through the process of applying for DACA. And you see that form-filling capacity in the number of tools that we've built. So we've created a tool to help legal permanent residents become citizens called Citizenship Works. There's 9 million eligible legal permanent residents out there, but fewer than 10% apply for naturalization. So either because it's too expensive, they don't have access to support in their language, or it's complicated. So we built a user-friendly, mobile-responsive website that helps immigrants and their advocates apply for naturalization, and it's available in English, Spanish, and Chinese. And it's used by over 200 partners nationwide. Another example is, you know, we built a tool called IMI to help undocumented folks understand their rights, but more importantly, if they're eligible for a form of status or relief. And so this tool has helped thousands of immigrants nationwide identify whether they're eligible for a form of relief and connect to a legal service provider. So these are just a few examples of what we do. And we do it because the field needs this, but more importantly, because, you know, there's millions of immigrants out there that we can help now and whose resources we often can't make them access or allow them to access.
Most of my experience with immigration needs has been being an employer, sponsoring a variety of employees over the years towards citizenship, some taking more than a decade to go through the process. And it's been a mess. They've all required lawyers and time and money. Why do immigrants need help in this country?
We have a broken immigration system that is intentionally complex, is intentionally made for some and not others, and keeps information and pathways to status in the hands of experts. So these are lawyers and DOJ, Department of Justice accredited representatives. So there's a number of failures that we have as a system that makes immigration applying for status, coming to this country, very complex. And this is before the Trump administration came into power. So add on to that, an administration that's antagonistic towards all forms of immigration, not just unlawful or what they would call illegal immigration, but they're antagonistic towards people trying to become citizens, to individuals applying for asylum, to individuals, as we know, that are undocumented and in this country and have been recognized as being able to have DACA eligibility. So there's a number of structural and political challenges with our current immigration system that makes it very difficult to come here, work here, live here, or reconnect with family here.
I mean, it feels to me like something like Pocket DACA should be part of what the government provides when they institute a program like that. It feels almost a little distressing that there has to be a group like yours helping people so much with so many different products to get through the process.
That's absolutely right. An example, for instance, Citizenship Works is a product that we built that existed before the government responded with their own naturalization tool, which is something that we now have, but, you know, only exists when it comes to naturalization. We essentially are here to provide a real public option to individuals that are trying to engage in the immigration system in a way that's modern, safe, and advocates for the immigrant. So we consider ourselves as builders of critical digital legal infrastructure that require an immigration system. And unfortunately, like you're pointing out, the federal government doesn't provide this infrastructure. And I think that's to a degree okay. I think we should make it very easy for individuals to apply for status through the federal government. But in a political dynamic like you have now, in some cases, it's risky for individuals to apply for status or to apply for naturalization. So the tools that we provide as advocates that help the immigrant advocate for their interests, that advise them on whether there's a red flag with a question that they've answered, is essentially also a good way of keeping, you know, the space more competitive, but also accountable. And it's a way for us to advocate for the immigrant, irrespective of what the federal government or the policy of the government might be at that time.
Is there any risk that the government could get access to your records and discover who's using your tools?
There is a legal risk, but we're very careful to mitigate against that risk. Many of our tools don't ask for personally identifiable information. So you can use imi.org if you're undocumented without telling us your name or your birth date or anything that would identify you as a user of the tool. But I guess, you know, the federal government could subpoena us, but we would obviously fight that tooth and nail. So there's certainly a risk, but so far it really hasn't come up as something that is of concern to the federal government, because it really shouldn't be.
How do you navigate that line between illegal or undocumented and, you know, people who came in documented or legal and are kind of in the process. How do you see that line and how do you deal with it as an organization?
We don't really see the line. We consider everyone that is trying to make their way in this country as someone that we should be supporting. You know, anyone that's coming from abroad or that came here as a child and is growing up as an American but has a foreign passport. So we don't really see the line. We don't treat individuals differently. We do evaluate their level of risk if they're undocumented and safeguard our platform so that we don't collect information that could put them at risk. I would say that that's the only distinction. As an organization, we don't discriminate or feel that one type of immigrant is any lesser or less deserving of status than another.
It's kind of interesting that, you know, if you come to this country, you get such a mixed reception. You have people, many people who welcome you, who want to integrate you into their communities, who value your whatever you're providing to the country, which is a great deal for most immigrants. And then you also have people who are very leery of all kinds of immigrants of different sorts, including this administration. What do you wish were the case for people coming to the United States? What should be wholly different?
I think when you look at the history of this country, when you look at the waves of foreign or non-US nationals that come to this country, you see a history of individuals bringing their cultures, bringing their work ethic, bringing their values to what we all consider an American value system and an American, I guess, identity. So I think we need to reflect on that tradition. We need to think about how this country is really, you know, out of many one, like our E Pluribus Unum motto says, and think about the ways that we continue that tradition, that we make it so that more individuals who want to come here, who want to reconnect with family here, and that want to continue to build this country together can do that in a way that's safe, in a way that gives them the best opportunities to thrive, and at the same time, make sure that communities are able to support them and that their governments are ready to support them.
Do you think there should be any limit on the number of people that we welcome?
Personally, I don't. I don't believe that we should limit or restrain migration. I think I'm an economist by training, and I think the market does that on its own. So I personally don't believe that there should be any quotas or limitations to the number of people or the type of people that come to this country. But that's my personal view.
When Trump launched his primary campaign, it was dramatically anti-immigrant and particularly pointed at Mexico. You got to have taken that personally. What were you doing at the time and how did you view that?
I was born in Mexico. I'm a proud Mexican-American immigrant. I have family in Mexico and family here that I love and neighbors that I love who I know were very much offended by those remarks. I was personally offended by those remarks. I was not surprised. But I was a little bit shocked at the number of people that heard those remarks and said, that's my guy, that's my candidate. Personally, I was working for the city of New York when Trump made that announcement and very quickly got engaged on national advocacy issues during the Trump campaign because I wanted to make an impact. And that's when I came to an organization called Purpose to work on, you know, national issue-based campaigns and found myself where I am now at the Immigration Advocates Network. So, I took it personally, but I also took it as a call to action and as a rallying call, I think, for the work that I do now and the work that I see a lot of people doing around the country.
What concretely has the change in administration from Obama to Trump meant for the immigration community, the advocates, and the people trying to navigate the system?
Obviously, there's been a number of policy changes, including family separation, challenges to our asylum process and our asylum laws, challenges to naturalization, to DACA, to temporary protected status. So there's a number of policy changes that are very tragic and harmful and are hurting people every day. Outside of those concrete policy changes, I would say there's an attitude shift in the advocacy community where the federal government is no longer seen as even an incompetent ally or an incompetent partner as maybe they might have been seen as before. You know, there's a sense that the federal government is not to be trusted, that information that, you know, advocates might have shared in the past for data collection purposes or for advocacy purposes maybe can't be as confidently shared. So I think the dynamic has shifted. It's made people like us that build ways of engaging with a federal process in a safe way much more attractive and much more important and needed. It's really forced us to recognize the value that the advocacy community provides outside of, you know, whatever good intentions a politician might have when they're in government and good intentions that they might have towards immigrants as policymakers.
How much damage do you think has been done? How long do you think it will be to take to undo the Trump administration's changes if we get a more pro-immigration administration?
The optimist in me wants to say that, and again, this is my personal view, not the of the organizations, but the optimist in me wants to say that this next administration, if it's not Trump, is hopefully going to be a period of healing and can make it so that the wrongs of this current administration are erased or at least mitigated. But the realist in me thinks that the damage is irreparable and it's generational and we don't really understand it fully yet. There's clear changes in policy that can be reversed in a new government. But then there's a real human damage and impact that these policies have caused. You know, I work with a lot of undocumented folks, and they've been living in a moment of terror. And this is a fear that you don't only see in parents, but you see in children, you see in young individuals whose brains are developing and who are experiencing trauma at a very young age. So I think the damage, sadly, is generational. It's prolonged, and I think we have a lot of work to do if we think we're going to reverse or help mitigate against those harms.
That rings really true to me. If the Trump administration has been determined about any particular thing, it's been on this topic. Stephen Miller there in the White House, Trump himself, they have put energy and dedicated time and resources into trying to discourage people from coming here, demonizing people who are here. I mean, it feels to me like it's going to take double the energy in the other direction. And it's hard to know with everything that needs to be done, how that can happen or will it happen?
I think that's right. My hope is that, and I think across a number of issues, my hope is that this moment has shown us how cruel we can be as a people and as a government. Towards the most vulnerable and the least empowered, and that we take the opportunity that this lesson has taught us to make those wrongs right, not just because they happened now, but because they've been part of our history and our policy for a number of years before Trump was even in office. It's a moment of reckoning, and my hope is that we seize that moment and undo systemic wrongs.
Now, of course, there's a very good chance, unfortunately, that Trump gets reelected. It's certainly a long way to go. And, you know, we learned last time that where the polls are now doesn't mean that's where they end. What would it mean if he got four more years to work on what he's been already doing?
Four more years of a government with this type of view towards immigration, and again, all forms of immigration, not just the kind that he considers not in the interests of this country, would, in my opinion, bring about a continued recession and even depression. It would bring about continued trauma in immigrant communities, not only those that are escaping or leaving countries of origin, but also in immigrant communities in this country that are trying to reconnect with family members whose families have been broken apart by this government. I really can't imagine what four more years of this would look like. And I certainly hope that on a personal level that we don't see four more years of this type of activity and just philosophy towards individuals that are coming to this country with the best intentions in mind.
When you think about the progressive ecosystem and the aspects of it that are focused on immigration, what organizations do you think are really making a difference in the fight?
This moment has really shown us the power of advocacy at all levels. So there's been incredible litigation conducted by the ACLU, National Immigration Law Center, Immigration Legal Resource Center, that has stopped a lot of the cruelest actions of this administration. So on the legal front, there's a number of incredible work that's been happening. And then at the grassroots level, we've seen local nonprofits, local volunteer groups rise to the occasion to protect and support their immigrant neighbors. And you see this in, you know, mutual aid networks now. You see it in ICE Watch protection that's happening at the local level. You see this amongst the faith community too. You know, a whole network of sanctuary spaces has been developed in this country or expanded upon in this country in the last couple of years out of necessity to keep people safe from harm. Groups like the Sanctuary Coalition is a leader in this space. We've also seen incredible activism out of the undocumented youth movement. So organizations like United We Dream, like the New York State Youth Leadership Council, and others that have forced us to really lead with our values when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform and think about entire family units and not just undocumented youth as individuals that need support at this moment.
How do you read the sort of national politics of immigration? I mean, Trump seems to think it's his ace in the hole. He kind of returns to that, you know, with the caravan scare tactics right before the midterms. You can see it coming again in this fall as one of the arrows in his quiver. You mentioned being surprised, but there's clearly some proportion of the country which buys the argument that they're competing for jobs. It's pretty obvious, the tactic. How do you see the reality?
It's a very clear tactic, and it's a way of galvanizing a segment of the population that sadly sees the world in this way. But I also think it's backfired. When we had family separation at its most evil, we saw clear backfiring of that policy, even amongst his base, you know, especially amongst the evangelical community. There was, you know, a clear notion that he had gone too far and that what he was doing, you know, thanks to the advocacy of many and the reporting of many news outlets, was truly not in our interest and was evil and was damaging families that live in our communities and that we would recognize if we saw them at the supermarket. So I think it's backfired at times. It's clearly not in the interest of this country and this country's economy. You know, we've seen people from the states that Trump wants to win complain about limitations to hiring farm workers. I think the business community, especially in the tech sector and other sectors that want to attract specialized talent to this country, are seeing the damage in their companies and in their bottom line. So there is a growing coalition of actors that you would consider Trump supporters traditionally or Republican supporters that I think are organizing against this antagonistic attitude or posture towards immigration.
Do you see any efforts to help make it backfire more in the fall that are being put together? I mean, if he's at work trying to play the card one way, it would be nice if we're playing the card the other way.
One consideration, and again, this is my personal view, that, you know, the Trump campaign should have is that there are over 5 million individuals who have naturalized during this administration that are now prepared to vote. And there is a segment, a growing segment of our country that sees immigration as an issue they should vote on. That includes, you know, immigrants themselves, but also the Latinx voting population that has immigrant family members or is trying to reconnect with family members, you know, individuals that live in the states that Trump needs to win, like Florida, Michigan, Texas, Pennsylvania. We see large interest groups that I would consider important for anyone trying to govern nationally. And there's actually a campaign now led by the National Partnership for New Americans. It's called New American Voters 2020 to help mobilize recently naturalized Americans to vote and make their voices heard and be a game changer in this next election.
Tell me a little bit about your job. What is your time spent on? What are your big challenges?
My job is pretty varied. I work a lot with our partners in the field. So, you know, we see ourselves as the people behind the people helping immigrants in this country. And so what we're trying to do now, and as of late, is sort of think beyond immigration law, for instance, and more importantly, how the law impacts immigrants adversely. So, you know, my job is spent thinking about issues and needs, but also around how we built scalable solutions to help immigrants and their advocates nationwide. And right now, some of that focus is on the issue of wage theft, where we've seen over the years, immigrants suffer disproportionately to what is really a national problem. And so we've been focusing as of late on addressing the issue of wage theft at scale, especially now when we're in an era of economic recession, but also an era where immigrants are afraid to work and employers feel emboldened by this administration to take advantage of them. And so we're trying to build a way to address wage theft at a national and state level. And we're really excited about that because that's something that we can address irrespective of federal immigration policy.
It seems like there's a tech side of your operation building these tools. Do you build that all in-house? Do you use tech partners to help you? How do you run that element?
There's a big tech component, and we are essentially product managers and product developers. We have our own tech team in-house that helps us produce business requirements, helps us project manage. We have a CTO. You know, we work with developers around the country to build the tools, but a lot of my time and a lot of what I spend doing is helping, really listening to advocates on the ground, thinking about their challenges in using the law to help immigrants around this country and how we can make those challenges lesser or how we can use what they're doing on the ground to help inform advocacy. So I spend a lot of time thinking like a tech strategist and an organizer and also like a reporter and listening and taking notes and thinking strategically around what I'm hearing our partners and allies.
When you think about the resources and the tools that are available to immigrants and to advocates for immigrants, what do you think is missing? What would you like to see created that's not yet there?
I think there's a lot there already. And there's actually a lot there that is currently offered by the private sector too. So one thing to kind of keep in mind is what we're doing is that we're working in the immigrant legal tech space as a not-for-profit organization, but there's a lot of for-profit partners or organizations that do the same thing or at least do it in a different way for profit. So I would say that we obviously need more groups like us doing it for free, doing it with a mission and set of values. But I really think more importantly, we need to come together as a movement and recognize that innovation doesn't only have to happen at Facebook or at Uber or at Tesla. Innovation in how we help people, innovation in how we advocate and how we address systemic challenges needs to happen in the immigrant justice space as well. So for me, having these conversations and pushing the envelope as to what we can do together as a movement using all the tools at our disposal is what I would like to see more of.
Is there a question about what you do or your organization that I haven't asked that you'd like to answer?
How we're funded?
I usually ask that. How are you funded?
You know, we receive support from a handful of national philanthropic institutions that see the value in an organization like ours that's supporting this movement in a very structural way. So we primarily benefit from the support of national immigrant rights funders. And increasingly, we are exploring making our tools accessible for cities and states and other organizations that can benefit from what we've built at a fee-for-service type model.
And how's that going?
It's going. You know, we are, especially in this moment where, you know, if you are a service provider, you can't help people in person. So what we've created helps organizations work remotely, helps them see clients and help them with just the use of a smartphone. So at this moment right now, where we are all social distancing and can't come together like we have in the past, the remote legal service tools that we've built are really critical and important, I think, receiving much more attention because we can't do large immigration workshops anymore. We can't do in-person direct services like we used to. So I think it's a good moment for the movement to adopt technology and use what we've built.
If I had a listener who's an immigrant looking for help or advocate looking to use your resources, or maybe just a regular citizen who'd like to be helpful, what advice would you give each of them to do?
For an audience member that is undocumented, I would tell them to visit us at immi.org, immi.org, learn about their status, learn about their eligibility for status, connect to local providers, know their rights, make a plan in the event of removal. For an advocate, I would invite them to join us, to be part of our 8,000-strong member network at immigrationadvocates.org. And for the average listener that isn't involved but wants to help, obviously donate to us, but also donate to local on-the-ground service providers. Talk to your representative. If you don't like the way that immigrants are being treated in your communities or nationally, let them know. And stay engaged, because while we don't see the headlines daily, there are daily crimes being committed, I would say, against individuals in our communities. And these are traumatic, irreparable acts of violence, I would say. And we need to pay attention to that and think about how we're going to deal with that as a society.
Rodrigo, it's really an honor to talk to you. I'm glad you're doing the work you're doing and happy to hear about your organization. Is there anything else you want to say?
Nathaniel, thank you so much for having me and for having this space. I really enjoyed the conversation.
I did too.
That was Rodrigo Camarena at Immigrant Advocates Network. He's at immigrantadvocates.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.